Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Chris Lord. The age of the rock star has passed. So says writer David Hepworth. He'll be in the studio later on to tell us about his new book, Uncommon People. And elsewhere, we'll be focusing on art. Joining me in the studio is private dealer and advisor Kathleen Fox-Davies and head of content for the Listen Gallery, Ossian Ward, to wrap up this year's Art Basel and look at some of the art shows on in London this month that you might have overlooked. All that and more right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. So Kathleen and Ossian, both welcome very much to the Monocle Arts Review. Thank you for joining us today. I thought we'd start over in Switzerland now. Last week, Art Basel wrapped up for the 48th edition of the Art Fair Behemoth, something of a bellwether for where the art market is going at the moment. And Ossian, you were there. Just give us a bit of a brief idea. What was the atmosphere like at this year's fair?
Yeah, you can always judge how busy an art fair is by how many people you see running out of the gate at 11 o'clock when the VIPs are let in. I saw one person running, but maybe they need to go to the loo. It wasn't that kind of frenzy. So when the frenzy starts, you know that it's going to be a busy year. But having said that, it was sort of the pace on the booths was quite relentless, meaning that there were people there for the first day, you know, streaming in constantly. And so, yeah, the mood was actually upbeat considering, you know, what's going on in the world.
Well, that's what's so striking about it. I mean, in the immediate aftermath of it closing at the weekend, people sort of immediately started saying, well, this is an extremely strong edition of the fair. Sales have been good, high visitor numbers. What, when you were talking to galleries, what kind of things were they putting that down to?
I don't know. I think that the sun was out. People were swimming in the Rhine. You know, I think it does make a difference what's going on outside in the immediate surroundings. Basel's usually a bit rainy and a bit gloomy. So the weather was good. People seemed to be interested in buying, not in a frenzy, as I said. But I think it's one thing to say that tier of collectors are not affected by, you know, commercial pressures. That's not exactly true. I would say it's more to do with Basel being the preeminent fair. You know, people know that they're going to go and see good stuff. They're going to take their best stuff. They're sort of banking on half a year's worth of revenues to make sure that, you know, Basel is successful. So if it's not, you tend to hear that pretty quickly, that people are you know, gloomy about it. But then it's going to be harder. The big galleries, my gallery will tell you, you know, that it's all going very well. The lower end is tougher because, you know, you've got smaller margins and younger galleries have to make deals very quickly. But, you know, even going to Lister, which is the smaller sister fair to Basel, where all the younger galleries are, you know, on the whole, they'd done really well. So they were all kind of sitting out getting a tan after the first day because, you know, the first wave of people in come, and if you're selling things at 10 to 20 to 30,000 pounds or euros, you're going to do very well when everything else at Basel is priced kind of £100,000 upwards.
So ultimately, they're sort of out there, younger galleries, trying to sort of get some of these younger names out there and noticed. Who caught your eye at the fair this year?
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to friends of mine from a London gallery called Suthard Reed at Lister, who'd had a beautiful booth of Prem Saib, which had sold very nicely. And I think, you know, Lister's patchy. You're always looking for sort of discoveries there. But I would say it's the first floor of Basel, the main fair, where you find the younger galleries. And they have all these different sections, like statements. I kind of forget what they're all called. But usually the best viewing experience is Art Unlimited, which is where you get to see these museum-style large installations and works, which they kind of add up to something. Some years you just think, you know, they've just put a load of stuff in a room. But, you know, there's performances, there are large-scale installations, there were kind of hour-long videos, a beautiful one by David Clareboot, which is remixing the Jungle Book and taking out all the human nature of the animals. So they look like animals again. So it's an hour-long film. But you find yourself sitting there for, you know, the best part of an hour. And other installations at Art Unlimited, you had,
I believe,
some,
Arthur Jaffa's piece was particularly standout.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one. It's called Apex. It's actually from 2013, and it has this kind of driving techno soundtrack, just very repetitive, and a flashing of images, almost like a slideshow, but much quicker, you know, boom, 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 different images. And it's quite tough. It's, you know, Arthur makes interesting work about the black culture about, I mean, all kinds of culture. You know, there's music, there's violence, there's biology, there's technology. It's very kind of this collage of images rushing at you. And that was a major highlight. And worth noting that he has a really good show at the Serpentine in London at the moment.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, what Unlimited shows you is that, you know, despite being a, you know, ultimately it is still an art fair, it's a place that people go to buy and sell art at its core, but then you can sort of create these areas within that that can be, you know, in many ways, very well curated, museum quality shows. Kathleen, I wanted to just bring you in here. I mean, you know, we started by talking about Art Basel as a sort of bellwether of the art world, and I just wonder what you thought about that. I mean, is, you know, what does Basel need to do at the moment to stay at the top? You know, it is still the sort of front line for where the market's going. And, it, you know, is there some sort of bigger challenges ahead, do you think, for that firm?
In my opinion, Basel is still the standard. It's the very top level of the art market. The areas that I operate and interact in are slightly lower, being a photography dealer. But it is still very indicative of where the market's going, because where the blue chip goes, the rest of it sort of follows. As we were saying earlier, the lower end is slightly more difficult. They are smaller margins. You have to do more to produce the same level that one or two sales in a large blue chip gallery would do. But it still is, it's the model for the market. So when Basel has a successful year, that pretty much shows how the rest of the year is going to go for everyone else.
Also, when you were walking around those booths and stuff, you know, there was a time, I think, in recent years where we've started to see a lot of pressure put on galleries that when they participate in fairs, it needs to be a robust show. It can't just quite simply be, you know, work standing like hostages in this sort of trade fair environment. It needs to feel, I suppose, ultimately engaging still for the public who are not necessarily there to buy. Does Basel still cut it in that way, or does it manage to sort of cut through and feel like a curated show like that?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's so busy. There's these, you know, these two floors packed to the gills. You have some sort of classic modern, and you have the sort of younger galleries upstairs, but people really just want to sell. So they're not putting on statement booths. They're not putting on solo shows. They're not taking so many risks. Doesn't mean you don't see good work, because the quality is high, but the name recognition is also high. You know who everyone is. I think that Unlimited kind of takes away the pressure for galleries to do that. So we put on our own Unlimited works by Corey Archangel, John O'Comfer and Susan Hiller, which, you know, sort of gives you that chance to show an artist at a different level and different scale and ambition, whereas on the booth you don't. But the best thing in Unlimited was undoubtedly Rob Pruitt's Art World lookalike. So he had portraits of an Art World celebrity and then a real celebrity, and they were very funny. So my favourites were Sam Keller, who looks like Dr. Evil with the bald head. Massimo De Carlo looks like DJ Khaled, which is really quite funny. Gavin Brown and Mark Ruffalo. Gavin is his dealer. And then there's some weirder ones like John Baldessari, Papa Smurf.
Oh, yeah.
And Marina Abramovic in a red brick wall. I'm not quite sure what that one's saying. But it was, you know, there are moments where you can kind of escape from the fair, but the fair is business.
Yeah, moments of levity in amongst it all. Okay, well, that was Art Basel. Now, Kathleen, we turn to you now. Let's talk about Australian photographer Murray Fredericks, whose work is currently on show at Hamilton's Gallery here in London. Kathleen, just tell us a little bit about this show and who Fredericks is as well.
Well, Murray Fredericks, obviously you've just opened it with, he's an Australian artist. This is the fourth generation of the SALT Project, which Hamilton's first showed in 2007. This is traditionally a large-scale colour photography, but he's dealing with landscape. He's dealing with the Australian landscape, specifically Lake Erie, which is a 3,500-mile salt flat that's prone to flooding in the middle of the Australian outback. It's a very unforgiving environment. It's an impossible landscape, almost Martian, very foreign feeling. And he has, I think, visited this space 20 times now, traveling, camping, staying for weeks at a time in this really harsh environment, taking his photographs of the landscape. With this incarnation, Vanity, he's actually inserting a mirror, which seems quite simple, maybe slightly contrived, but the result is minimalist and absolutely sublime. He walks for hours in order to get a horizon that's not, has no disruption. Mm. And he places this mirror, will then spend an hour or two polishing it to make sure it's absolutely perfect and waiting for the water to still, because even if he breathes, that creates a ripple effect. And they are landscapes of color and light, but the mirror, instead of it being reflected back to either him as the artist or you as the viewer, it's slightly off
Yeah,
angle.
When you look at these images, what you see is this sort of incredible, you know, had you mentioned perfect horizon, unblemished with any sort of interruptions. And then within it is this sort of, it's almost, the mirror is almost like a shard of sky that's kind of dropped into the scene there.
It's quite inorganic, actually.
It is inorganic, yeah. And it sort of, in fact, the way he sort of shoots it, it almost has this kind of digital effect. It doesn't really look, you know, because the landscape, as you mentioned, is so Martian, so foreign and surreal. It actually looks very contrived, actually.
It does. It's he is completely deconstructing our traditional view of what landscape photography is and could be. And he's disrupting that perfect horizon line by inserting this mirror. And because we live in a modern age where within photography we are so used to the impossible happening through Photoshop and everything else, you stand in front of this really scratching your head going, how has he done this? They don't look like landscapes anymore. They are beautiful, abstract, minimalist, conceptual images of light and color.
And yet ironically created in ultimately quite simple means, really. I mean, the difficult part in many ways of this is the fact that he's traveling back and forth, as you mentioned, to Lake Erie, which is this sort of extremely harsh environment. He's on his bicycle for quite a lot of it, as I understand,
pulling a wagon with 70-pound mirrors,
so dragging a mirror through this surreal landscape as well. I mean, I think, you know, it is a sort of difficult journey. I wonder, are these photographs about that journey a little bit?
The photographs really aren't about the journey, which I think some of how that conceptual performance that goes into creating these photographs is lost in the final production of the framed image on the wall. The gallery has most helpfully put a video, they've made a movie, where you can actually see what goes into making the images, which I think from a viewer coming to it expecting the traditional Murray Frederick's landscape, it was helpful to see how this process is. But the end result are really these empty landscapes. He is inserting the mirror, and here he's been quite vocal about saying how the mirror in this image is a symbol of narcissism and our own vanity as human beings, as humankind. He is, instead of drawing a mirror to our own reflection, our own faces, he's making us look away and look at what's beyond the frame, what's outside of us, what's behind us. These are meant to be comments on nature and environmentalism and our place as humans in this vast, expansive world, where in the world of Murray Frederick's and the landscapes he's created, we're small. We don't exist.
It's interesting. You mentioned before about, you know, we live in a time where, you know, Photoshop magic can do so much, and we sort of were surrounded by so many digitally altered images all the time. And I wondered, when I looked at this series, I wondered whether he was sort of making a bit of a comment about land art these days, about when we talk about land art and we think about what it is. It was very much about, you know, interjections into the landscape. How can an artist, you know, reshape that landscape in a very visceral, natural, or in some cases unnatural way to make a statement? And so when I look at these, and the rawness of it, it's literally a mirror in a very harsh and raw landscape. Do you think that that's sort of what he's thinking about a little bit here? It's sort of challenging this very saturated digital world that we live in of imagery and photography these days.
Well, he certainly is turning that concept on its head, and this very much is in that tradition of land art. He's not creating a permanent structure or cathedral of any means for us to go and visit in the way that Robert Smithson would with Spiral Jetty and that sort of thing. But he is taking an untouched, almost Martian landscape and inserting himself into it. And the way he's inserting himself in is this mirror. So you know he's been there, but there's actually no sign of human touch. It's really hard to tell what's been disrupted, because all he's doing is just offering a different view of this perfect, impossible environment.
Well, if that's piqued your interest, do as Murray Frederick's does, hop on your bicycle and head to the Hamilton's Gallery here in London until 7th of July, Salt Vanity, that is. Now we head over to the South London Gallery for an exhibition called The Place Is Here. Ossian, just what's the premise of this new show?
So it's a touring exhibition. It came from Nottingham, so it's slightly smaller. The South London Gallery has split it between here and a natural partner in Middlesbrough, miles away. But anyway, it's a really interesting show, 25 artists, and it's about Black British culture, or kind of ethnic British culture, mainly in the 80s. So it's talking about what I almost see as like sort of, there's like a lost generation of artists here who were sort of obviously struggling to get their word and their expression out. And in some cases they did. You know, you will recognise some names, Isaac Julian, Zarina Bimji and Mona Hatoum. But actually, what's striking is that there were some great artists who didn't get anywhere, if you like. And this is just in the run-up to, there's a big exhibition at Tate Modern coming called Soul of a Nation, which is a kind of Black Power era exhibition. So it's sort of the same type of thing, mainly looking at American, African-American artists. But we don't talk about our Afro-Caribbean heritage in the same way, or in fact, we're only just starting to. So that's the premise of the show. And it's really interesting because you have this kind of idea of racial politics, actual politics, you know, what was going on in the 80s in terms of gender and sexuality as well. So it's quite a broad brush. And like I said, the South London Gallery is only big enough to fit in a small amount of it. Lots of archival material.
I mean, one of the things when you mentioned that about the political moment of the 1980s, you know, when we think of things, certainly in sort of the Black British experience, you think of things like Brixton riots, for instance. We think of the fact that it was the Thatcher era, of course. And also, you know, certain elements of life at that time that have a little bit of echoes of our own time a little bit. You know, with, you know, at the moment, we talk a lot about inequality. We've just seen here in London, the Grenfell fire, of course, people talking about what it means in this city, in this country, to be a have-not, to be someone who's pushed out of the narrative. And as you mentioned, a lot of these artists, unfortunately, have not maybe got the recognition that they deserve. One thing when I looked across this show, and it's sort of, it was a bit of the time, especially when I think of someone like Mona Hatoum, there was a very DIY feeling to a lot of this work. You know, it was a sense of lots of performance, ephemeral activities, I think, a little bit as well. Gestures that were bold, but also very, very simple. It wasn't, you know, you did not need to be necessarily somebody who had access to great materials, resources. You could make very scratchy and DIY work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. The kind of collagistic view is there. And in a funny kind of way, it also links to Arthur Jaffa's show at the Serpentine, although, again, he's American, not British. But there are connections. So, for example, I mentioned John Okomfra, who we work with at Listen Gallery. He started with a group of other people, the Black Audio Film Collective. And there's a beautiful work in the show called Twilight City from 1989, which is a sort of follow-up to the Handsworth Songs film, which is a bit more about race riots in Birmingham. And there are some works in here about Chapel Town and, you know, as you were saying, the kind of Brixton situation. But what was interesting was, apart from the Black Audio Film Collective, there were also the Sankofa Film and Video Collective, which I'd not been aware of before, but it included people like Isaac Julian working in the same sort of realm. So, yes, it's DIY, but these guys were making complex, long films supported by Channel 4, supported by the Arts Council. So they were by no means completely overridden or misunderstood or overlooked. It's just that it's like the opportunities to carry on weren't there, when the commercial imperative wasn't there. I'm not quite sure what happened, but it's interesting you mentioned this kind of political idea about Grenfell, because there are strange echoes, even though this show has nothing to do with that. You know, the South London Gallery has just been gifted this amazing fire station space next door, which was closed down as a fire station. And even more kind of harrowingly, just behind the South London Gallery was a big block of flats that went up about 4 or 5 years ago. And it was a near Grenfell disaster. So basically, the same sort of thing happened. The flames leapt up on the outside because they had these balconies that were full of stuff and that, you know, wasn't really very well looked after in terms of fire safety. So I don't want to get too political because that's not really the point of the show. But that it does affect people. You know, I think the idea that the art world is rarefied and doesn't touch people, doesn't touch daily lives, is kind of disproven by this. I mean, this is a real South London Gallery show. It's a community. And I didn't know the existence of the Black Art Gallery, for example, in Finsbury Park, or the Brixton Art Gallery.
So it's about connecting these spaces and sort of, you know, really looking at what's already here in London and saying what's out there. But this connection with Middlesbrough, though, where does that come into the show?
I think it's basically that they had to work out how to split the show because the Nottingham contemporary version of it was bigger. So South London Gallery only has kind of two or three beautiful spaces. So they must have decided that that was a good... And what I know of Middlesbrough and the director is that he's very much... Middlesbrough is an incredible proportion of minorities. So I think it's one of the highest in the country. So it was a natural fit for him. And he also believes very much in this kind of usefulness of art, the idea that art can and should be seen by the community and is not just for some sort of rarefied art going public.
That's very interesting indeed. Now, you mentioned as well, of course, this forthcoming Tate Modern show that's going to be looking at sort of Black art from America. Is there a sense when you walk around here that it's there is a sort of communication between those two shows that are going to be happening? You know, do you think there is a feeling of the South London Gallery, you know, talking to Tate Modern and sort of working out how they can kind of, you know, be in some way in communication with each other, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know, because I see, like, especially with that Twilight City, which is about sort of going through London at a certain time of night. It's a very British show. I don't get the feeling that there were these networks of connection. You know, it's almost like the networks were between discrete collectives, like these Black Audio Film collectives or the Sankofa collectives, rather than between London and New York. I think they were sort of looking for partnerships and working relationships within our own country or with our own city even. And I think that's the same in America. You know, I haven't seen this show yet. It opens in July. But, you know, the idea that Harlem were very much a kind of one community and, you know, different parts of America have different discrete communities. And it's more about them talking rather than talking to each other. Now, of course, it's accepted. You know, the idea that John Okomfra can write an essay in the Arthur Jaffa catalogue for the Serpentine, that's much more how we feel now. We feel much more connected globally. But I'm not sure. It feels like a very kind of British show, this one. You know, it's from the 80s. It has all of that kind of nostalgia attached to it. And it speaks to me of kind of missed opportunities. You know, what happened to some of these artists? Some of them I do know what happened to. And, you know, and it's interesting to see how little opportunity there's been in the interim.
You know, it's very exciting when exhibitions do start to establish forgotten art histories. I think that's very important. You mentioned the Sankofa collective there. Of course, Sankofa is a Ghanaian word, means literally go back and get it, you know. Okay. And it's sort of about going back into the past and working out what was forgotten and can you bring it back to the future and bring it back to our time. So very, very interesting. The Place Is Here is on at the South London Gallery until 10th of September and, of course, in the Middlesbrough Institute of Modern Art until 8th of October. Now, for a final look, we're going to head to the Photographers' Gallery, who currently have a major show of work by American artist Gregory Crudston. This is the first time that the gallery has dedicated all three of its spaces to one artist. And Kathleen, is it any good?
I think it's fantastic. As you said, this is the first time the Photographer's Gallery has dedicated all of its gallery space to one artist. This is the first exhibition of this body of work by Gregory Crudston in the UK. And this is after the artist has almost taken what I'd call an exile. He had a real moment of personal crisis, of creative crisis as well. He left New York, took himself off into the woods to Western Massachusetts, which is a place where he spent a lot of his childhood, and really had to find himself again. And this body of work, Cathedral of the Pines, is that playing out.
It's extremely striking works. I mean, just to sort of describe it, I mean, some of the pieces from here, they have a very painterly quality to them, first of all. And what you actually see, these sort of, as you mentioned, sort of very rural communities, people quite often in sort of clapboard wooden houses. Mm. Outside, you see this extremely sort of, you know, quite often epic landscapes, snowy, a sort of sense of isolation. And people basically having sort of very humdrum existence in and amongst it all, you know, watching television, sitting in darkened rooms and so on. And there's this sort of, you know, as I mentioned, when you look at some of the poses that people have and the sort of the positions that are in, it's a sort of painterly gesture about it all, isn't it?
It is incredibly painterly. With this specific project, he really is looking at 19th century landscape painting as his inspiration. You do see the colours, the textures coming through in these photographs. What is most striking is the light from these works. Everything is coming from the exterior in. So these interiors, these quite sad, dilapidated, depressing spaces where you find moments of the subjects, whether they are having, you don't know what's happening. They're quite depressing. There is an innate sadness. There is an anxiety inherent. It hints of psychological trauma, but with the color palette that's used, with the shadows, with these forlorn looks on the characters' faces. And he really is looking at 19th century painting rather than his traditional sort of cinematic, big Hollywood film approach.
Yeah, what happened to the celebrities? There's usually the, you know, the famous faces.
This is where this work is such a departure. Okay. He had, normally his productions, the last, Beneath the Roses, his last series, which was 5 years ago, it debuted. He had over 100 crew members working on this. It took almost 10 years. It had a mid-size Hollywood film budget. It was kind of insane for fine art photography. This, it's all families and friends. It's people he knows. It's incredibly intimate. I think the crew is less than 30 30 people. It was shot over 2 summers and 1 winter in Western Massachusetts amongst people that he knows and trusts. It's very intimate. It's playing out his own psychological traumas that we see happening here. But also, I think it's a bigger comment on the American psychology. You've got he plays with this idea of the uncanny. He's obsessed with the Freudian idea of the uncanny, which possibly is from the fact that his father practiced psychology, specifically Freudian psychoanalysis. And he told this, I don't know where I saw this, but he told this wonderful story at one point. He grew up in Brooklyn. His father kept an office in the basement, and he never knew what happened in his father's office. He didn't know what his father did, but he knew that it seemed to always have a very secretive veil over it. And he and his siblings remember putting their ear to the floor to be able to catch moments of what was going on in his father's office, in his practice. And you almost see that same idea playing out in his body of work over the last 20 years.
It's very voyeuristic.
I
wonder, you know, this sort of connection with 19th century landscape paintings, is there sort of, you know, when we think of sort of the romanticism of the 19th century, and we think of sort of what landscapes meant at a certain time, certainly in the European tradition, for instance, is there a sort of sense of like a kind of psychogeography here almost? Do you know what I mean? When you paint these sort of images of this very, you know, as you mentioned, somewhat depressing, quite bleak interior worlds of the house and watching television, and then beyond it, this sort of very foreboding landscape. I mean, where's he going with that, do you think?
Well, with this project specifically, what I found so striking is that while you do have these interior spaces, the majority of the show is taken outside. It's taken into nature, where the subjects are quite small within the grand scale of this overgrown green landscape. It's named after, Cathedral of the Pines is actually named after a trail that Crudson said the veil lifted and he found himself again. And that's why he decided to shoot this series here in nature. It is about him exiling himself to find his own salvation. And you do see that playing out, whether it be titles of books that he's placed within one of the living rooms, where the titles are quite amazingly Outside Eden, The Snakes and Their Ways. There's a board game called Snake's Eye. So he is talking about this almost spoiled Eden, but it's still the place of salvation still. And the subjects where they are normally the end all of his compositions are quite small and dwarfed in comparison to this encroaching nature coming from the windows.
As one feels when one stands in a cathedral, as it is, you know, one feels dwarfed and sort of a sense of awe as well. So that was Gregory Crudson, Cathedral of the Pines, on at the Photographer's Gallery here in London until the 8th of October. Kathleen Fox-Davis and Ossian Ward, thank you very much for your art reviews today. It's not quite over just yet, though. The age of the rock star has passed. That's the controversial statement from renowned music journalist David Hepworth in his new book, Uncommon People, The Rise and Fall of the Rock Stars. The book explores defining moments in the lives of 40 rock stars from 1955 to 1994, all the way from Little Richard to Kurt Cobain. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Hepworth about his new book.
I love them. I don't care what anybody thinks. I love the Beatles for them, and I'll always love them.
I wanted to write something about rock stars as a tribe, you know, their tribal characteristics, because I'd spent a lot of time observing them and interacting with them. And musicians, when they say to you, when they want to flatter you, they always say the good thing about you is you're like the music, not the personalities. And of course, that's not true. I really like the personalities, and I've always been just as interested in the personalities as the music. And I suppose that's what a rock star is. It's the combination of the personality and the music. One reflects the other. And so when I sat down to write the book, I quickly realised that the age of the rock star is over, really, and that there aren't any anymore. That then kind of ties in with the theory that musical eras of any kind tend to have 40 years. 40 years is just about as long as they can sustain interest. They repeat themselves. Once they start repeating themselves more than once, it's gone on too long. And so you can find the same thing. If you look at jazz kind of started at the end of the First World War and ended as a big popular music at the end of the 1950s. Now, country music started at the end of the 1920s. Finished at the end of the 1960s. And so my rock star era starts in 1955 and finishes in 1994 with the death of Kurt Cobain.
Why do you think it finished? Do you think perhaps artists, you know, they're too worried about their PR, they're more controlling about their image? Or, as you said, it was just an era that's
I think
gone.
It's partly an era because, you know, we'd already entered in 1994, I suppose we'd already entered it, the era we're still in nowadays, which I suppose is the hip-hop era, you know, which is probably arguably coming to its end now, you know, and you tend to have one form of music that's kind of dominant, you know. So if you look at the 1930s and 40s, the dominant form of popular music is jazz. And if you look at the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the dominant form of popular music is rock, you know. And since then, it's been hip hop. So, you know, partly it's hip hop, partly we have a generation of stars nowadays, and we have musical stars, of course we still do, bigger than ever probably, but they're very risk averse, I would say, as a breed, because of kind of the way they've been developed, really. It's always interesting to me just how many of them have been kind of trained from children as, you know, I don't know, as Mouseketeers or stage school or whatever. You can find loads and loads of cases of these people. You know, so at the age of 14, they were already tough professionals, these people. Whereas the people I've written about in Uncommon People, I like to think one of the interesting things about them was that they came from normal life, really. They sprang from the same places as we did, but they were larger than us. They operated on a bigger scale than we did, you know. But they belonged to the same world. Whereas I think nowadays you have a kind of professional army of entertainers. Very different.
That's a very good point because, you know, I'm a huge Madonna fan, for example. She's a classic example, you know, that she went to New York. I think she had like, I don't know, $30 in her pocket, you know. And it's true. These days, probably you've been trained musically. A lot of musicians actually are coming from the middle classes as well. That's another trend we've seen recently as well.
Well, yes, certainly. But I mean, that's always gone on, really. We now have schools that train people to be, you know, performers, to be pop stars. You know, it used to be the kind of thing that you had to kind of go off and invent for yourself, you know. So that moment passed and it's been replaced by another moment. But I just wanted to write a book about that moment, you know, how it happened, how it started in the 1950s. With Little Richard and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Buddy Holly and so forth, and how it kind of blossomed in the 1960s with Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones and so forth, how it got more kind of interesting and clever in the 1970s, and how it got bigger in the 1980s, and eventually how it got so big in the 1990s that nobody could really deal with it anymore. You know, so you had this tragic case of Kurt Cobain, who sees himself as a kind of, I'm a punk rocker, you know, I'm out there on the edge. But at the same time, he's earning sums of money, which even the Beatles could never have dreamed of, because the market for music is far bigger than ever before, and it's far more profitable than ever before. And so it's an extraordinary journey from 1955, where Little Richard kind of accidentally invents being a rock star, you know, and the Beatles emulate Little Richard and Elvis Presley, and suddenly become far bigger than anybody can dream of, you know. We just have this incredible trajectory over a period of 40 years. And one of the things that fascinates me is that while we don't have rock stars anymore, although we have rock musicians and famous rock musicians, obviously you do, but we don't really have rock stars anymore. At the same time, we apply the term rock star to all kinds of people who are not rock stars. We talk about politician rock stars, we talk about chef rock stars, artist rock stars, you know, computer games designers, rock stars, you know. So what is it about rock star that we think is such a wonderful term of approval? And I think it's because we identify in it a certain form of kind of independence, if not outright recklessness, which we wouldn't dare do ourselves. But we like to feel that there was somebody there doing it on our behalf.
I think the reason why people like, as well, the idea of rock stars, there's also the element of excess as well, of being outrageous. For example, you know, Duran Duran in the 80s with their, you know, very expensive sexual video clips as well. So there's an element of pushing the buttons as well.
Well, we all like the idea of that. We like the idea that somebody's doing that on our behalf. I think personally, I think it's always been exaggerated madly. You know, it's interesting that the major myths about rock stars were, you know, and you'd always get the people quote the same ones: Keith Moon driving a Rolls Royce into a swimming pool, Keith Richards having his blood changed every year, you know, Marianne Faithfull and a Mars bar at the Redlands when the police arrived in 1967. None of them were true. None of those stories are true. But we really want those stories to be true, you know. And so you get later generations rock stars trying to pretend that that kind of thing is true. There's a case I actually quote in the book. In 1972, the Rolling Stones at their height, the Exile Main Street tour of the States, which broke records in all kinds of ways. And they were accompanied by a documentary crew. After a while, the director said, "We need more incidents for this film because it's sort of not exciting enough." And so they staged a sexual orgy on board the aeroplane between gigs. They staged throwing a television set out of a hotel room window because otherwise there was no kind of outrage. And you watch these guys lifting a television set, a 1970s television set, out of a hotel room window. And you can see why nobody does it. It's really hard to do.
Yes.
It's really difficult to do.
Let's talk a little bit about the format of the book. So, you know, you look at them chronologically, and so you chose like 40 rock stars, right? So you start with Little Richard and end with Kurt Cobain.
Well, yeah, because what I wanted to do is, because I'm covering a 40-year period, what I said I'm going to do is one day, one artist in each of those years, when there was some defining moment, when they did something that changed something. It was either, you know, Little Richard making his first record, Tutti Frutti, which completely made by mistake, or it was Paul McCartney arriving in New York in 1968 and announcing to a press conference that he and John Lennon no longer needed any money because they had enough money and they were just going to give it all away. It's all funny now in retrospect, isn't it? And, you know, up to, you know, you got Madonna in Toronto in 1990, where she rather hopes she's going to get arrested, you know, for a lewd, lascivious performance of Like a Virgin. And to her disappointment, she's not arrested, you know, which kind of indicates how difficult it is to offend people as the world gets more and more liberal, right through to the death of Kurt Cobain. So I hope that in reading it, people will get it a little bit like the experience of looking at a flick book, where you see the figure of the rock star change over those years. Because a rock star was never quite just in one mould. It wasn't the fashion editor's view of a rock star. It's somebody wearing leather trousers who looks like Axl Rose, you know. Well, a rock star was all kinds of things. A rock star was Buddy Holly. A rock star was Ian Dury, you know. It came in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And that's one of the interesting things about it. Somebody was, an American writer said about the Beatles in 1963, he said, they seemed like new kind of people. And I think that's one of the things rock stars did. They introduced us to loads of new kinds of people that we would never have met any other way, you know. And they haunted our imaginations for a long, long time.
That was David Hepworth. Uncommon People, The Rise and Fall of the Rock Stars is out now. He was talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who has joined us now in the studio. Fernando, for today's global countdown, we're going to head to Latin America, somewhere very close to your heart and home, of course.
Absolutely.
And to Venezuela. Although the country is more frequently in the news these days because of its dire political situation, let's see what Venezuelans are actually listening to at the moment. Fernando, tell us about that top five this week.
Well, I'm glad I chose Venezuela this week because, you know, to be honest, when we read the papers, you know, all the whole situation, Nicolas Maduro, the protests. But let's be honest, I mean, they still have a very good music industry. And I said, let's look at the bright side as well, if we may as well. And it's interesting because, of course, Venezuela is another country where reggaeton is huge. And I have to say, I mean, I think that's the main story of perhaps of this decade musically as well, how reggaeton is spreading all over in Europe, in the US, even in Brazil, where, you know, traditionally we usually have only songs in Portuguese, but now we have some songs in Spanish as well, very much influenced by reggaeton.
What do you think about that, Fernando? I mean, when you think of, you know, the sort of march of reggaeton across the South of America, the South Americas, and also in Africa as well, extremely yes. influential there in the way it's sort of swept across the continent there. I mean, is there a case of, you know, it's all the way from Colombia through to Brazil, as you mentioned, you know, cumbia being influenced by reggaeton, obviously, you know, Brazilian music styles. Well, is there a case of possibly some being lost, do you think, in amongst all that? How does reggaeton sit with some of those indigenous styles, do you think?
Well, I think, to be honest, you know, the reason for the success of reggaeton is because it's a very easy rhythm. It kind of makes you happy, you know, it's kind of, and you know, you do mention the more kind of traditional rhythms, but to be honest, I think especially young people, they do love reggaeton, and you can say it's typically like Latin America, so it's kind of, it was their own product that they're exporting now. So instead of consuming like songs from the US straight away, they are actually exporting artists. So I actually think it's positive. It's not my favorite genre, but you know, well, if it's not my favorite genre, I have to say the top five here, it looks quite similar in some ways. I even did a checklist. I'll go briefly top five, but there are fast cars, mansions, sorry to say, women in lingerie, and the tropical house beat in all the songs and the video clips. So it's a bit of a cliche, but here we go.
Okay, so what's in at number five then?
And number five, we have the band from Venezuela called Guaco, Lágrimas No Más, or No More Tears. I have to say that's the more kind of, it's more similar to a ballad from the top five, because the top four is actually quite up-tempo, which is a good thing, you know, it's summer, and, you know, let's enjoy ourselves. Number four, we have Maluma. Maluma is from Colombia, and again, Maluma is one of the main major Latin American artists at the moment. So this song is called Felices Los Cuatro, or The Four of Us Are Happy. I didn't go deep into the lyrics, but I wonder who are the four of us, but, you know, it is a good song. Number three, we have an upcoming Venezuelan singer called Chino Miranda, and he also did a partnership with a Puerto Rican singer, Vicen. The song is called Quédate Comigo, or Stay With Me. The interesting thing here is about Vicen. He's from Puerto Rico. Luis Fonsi is also from Puerto Rico. Luis Fonsi, of course, I'm sure you guys heard Despacito. It's everywhere. And Puerto Rico is actually a machine of creation, like those reggaeton pop stars. I would say Puerto Rico is the Sweden of Latin America. You know, quite a small country, but very relevant.
You heard it here first. Exactly. Puerto Rico is the Sweden of Latin America.
That's just a good statement.
Just tell me a bit about, you know, this is obviously a Venezuelan artist who's led this collaboration. Does the political situation filter into it, to this music at all?
I wouldn't say so. Not in the lyrics. I think those artists try to avoid to be so political. But to be honest, you know, maybe there is a scene of a reggaeton that we don't know, that perhaps is not in the charts, that actually talk also about politically. Most of those songs, you know, are about love, about dancing. I don't see that those are as political songs. But, you know, it could happen.
And getting you know, people in Caracas moving at a difficult time, making, you know, keeping people dancing, I guess. You know, it's
absolutely.
It's definitely a difficult time over there. Who's in number two, Fernando?
Number two, we have Vicen, the Puerto Rican singer that I just mentioned, with another collaboration with a Dominican Puerto Rican rapper as well, Ozuna. The song is called Escape With Me, and again, the amount of bling bling in that song is fantastic. It reminds me of some of the rap videos from the 90s. It is quite extravagant. I think they spent quite a few million dollars in the video, I have to say. But shall we listen to the number one song?
Yeah, that's here, number one. This is Jesús y Yoki, Sinti. Well, that was Jesús y Yorky Sin T. And Fernando has just told me as well that would be his number one as well from this week's Venezuelan Top 5. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And I'm Chris Lord. Join us at the same time again next week. But for now, let's play the rest of that number one single in Venezuela, Jesús y Yorky Sin T.